in those days, it was so intense that I remember going to Monza and we had to go in plain clothes instead of our normal team kit because the team was so worried about Italian baggage handlers, you know, wrecking and stealing stuff. I remember walking through the paddock in that little fenced area to get to the paddock at Monza and people trying to reach through and grab my shirt and...
Well, hello and welcome to the James Allen on F1 podcast brought to you by Autosport. Well, the F1 season is almost over. Max Verstappen has joined Alain Prost and Sebastian Vettel as a four-time world champion. But there is one very important matter still to be resolved. The Formula One Constructors' Championship may not have the same cachet with the fans, but it matters a lot to the teams. Why? Because it decides how much F1 prize money they earn. But this year, it means a whole lot more. For the first time in 16 years, the two teams fighting it out are McLaren and Ferrari. This has echoes of the great years of Schumacher and Hakkinen, of Hamilton, Alonso, Raikkonen and Massa. Ferrari, believe it or not, has not won the title since 2008, and McLaren haven't won it since 1998. So whoever wins, it's going to be epic. Which of these great names is going to prevail? And how did we get here when the season started with a series of Red Bull 1-2 finishes? With me to discuss this, in the red corner, I have Rob Smedley, former race engineer to Felipe Massa at Ferrari, who now runs Smedley Group, which advises across the F1 spectrum on data and AI. In the papaya corner, we have BBC commentator, podcaster, and former McLaren mechanic, Mark Priestley. And acting as the independent referee is Jake Boxall-Legg. Welcome to you all.
Thank you very much, James. I think it's a bit intimidating because we've got Rob here, we've got Mark with us as well, and yourself all involved in 2008 season as well. I feel a little bit out of place, but hopefully I can contribute something.
How old were you in 2008?
I was 14.
Excellent, excellent. So you were paying attention?
Oh yeah,
probably definitely. More than Rob and Mark and I were, actually. So anyway,
I was drunk for most of it.
So McLaren lead the table with 608 points. As I work it out, Ferrari are just 24 points behind them, and we have two Grand Prix worth of a maximum of 44 points each and a sprint race in Qatar worth another 15. I've not got the same capability at maths as Rob Smedley, but I think that adds up to a total of 103 points that are up for grabs, and the gap is 24 going into the final two races. So who, in your view, has the momentum going into these last two races?
Well, I think McLaren have the momentum. I think it reminds me a lot of this season between those two teams reminds me a lot of 2008 and 2007, in fact, when it was very hard. You know, it's sometimes world championships, you know, they one team will be off at a canter at the start and then another team will come back and they're consistently better. And they'll overtake towards the end of the year and then that's it, done and dusted. And it hasn't been like that. It's been like 2007, 2008 when we kind of swapped who was the fastest car every few races. And you see somewhere, you know, we've had quite, you know, recently some Ferrari dominance. McLaren perhaps, you know, not delivering everything they could have done. And then just before that, you've got McLaren dominating. But I do think that overall, I would say that McLaren have the momentum.
It's a rich topic, this. We'll get on to who's got the strongest drivers, which car will suit the characteristics of Qatar and Abu Dhabi the best. But what's your view, Jake? Who's got the momentum? Do you agree with Rob?
I think to a certain degree, yes. But the thing is, we've had a few circuits now where McLaren hasn't been quite as strong and Ferrari's been a little bit better. Obviously, Las Vegas, complete anomaly where you have cold conditions, something where the really low track grip conditions as well was going to play a huge effect, and Mercedes was there to take advantage. But yeah, we do have Qatar and we do have Abu Dhabi coming along, a little bit more conventional circuits, let's say. So McLaren should perhaps have the advantage there. Ferrari does have a good sort of advantage in, you know, slow speed conditions. Cars very, very compliant. Drivers seem to be able to deal with it really nicely. But the next two circuits coming along don't really play into that so much as, let's say, you know, tracks like Singapore and other street venues like that. So I think the ball's in McLaren's court. It just has to make the most of it. It needs to not make any more strategic mistakes, not make any more tactical errors or anything like that. It just needs to, you know, close it out and finish it off.
That's interesting. So, Mark, I mean, you've been in this position before. You know what it's like when you're trying to defend these leads. Rob compared it to 07, 08. What's your feeling? Is it a full set then, believing that McLaren have got momentum?
I definitely think they've got momentum, but it's kind of interesting how quickly that momentum has built in terms of it wasn't there at the beginning. Clearly, that was all in the hands of Red Bull. It was from that sort of midway point, roughly, wasn't it, for McLaren? And since then, they've built up massive momentum. Yeah, they've had a few stumbling blocks along the way, like Las Vegas. But I think that's the nature of 2024 and the modern era of Formula One. It's got such a long season with 24 rounds. It's not like the days of back in the early sort of the mid-2000s when you had a much shorter season with much fewer races. And therefore, because of that, you had a much smaller variety of racetracks. And therefore, if you had a good car, it typically worked, you know, kind of everywhere because there weren't these real crazy anomalies. Whereas now we've got 24 races. We're going to very cold street tracks like Vegas. We've got a very bumpy circuits. We've got some weird and wonderful places, which I think is great for the variety from a fan's point of view. It does swing the performance up and down all the way. But it does mean that it's unlikely you can have a car designed perfectly for every single one of those different sets of environments. And so I think although they've got momentum in terms of the car is generally pretty good, and I agree with Jake, you know, the remaining two rounds probably on paper should suit McLaren more so, or at least bring McLaren back into their normal run of form than we saw at the last time out in Vegas. But it is a sort of anomaly of this new Formula One where we stretch the season out so far and go to some weird and wonderful racetracks.
At the beginning, I mentioned that, you know, it doesn't have the cachet, the Constructors' Championship, that the drivers does. You know, everyone sort of, especially the newer fans, I guess, particularly, it's like, who's the world champion? It's Max, it's Lewis, whatever. But when you're in a team, and certainly from my, and I'm sure Jake's perspective, having been very close to this sport, covering it for many, many years, very, very clear that the Constructors is really what the teams really want, don't
100%.
They? I mean, obviously prize money is a huge part of it. The difference between first, second, third is millions and millions of dollars. But it's also, you know, is it more for the team themselves, the prestige, the feeling? What's the vibe when you're winning a Constructors?
Yeah, of course it is. It's like you know, you and I are massive football fans. So it's like if you finish third in the league or fourth in the league, it's exactly the same thing. You know, whether or not your player gets the Ballon d'Or, that's nice and it's icing on the cake, but it's not really what you, you know, it's not really what you look at. So within the teams, of course, as you know, we should be candid and transparent about it. There's financial incentives, you know, for, you know, people like myself, Mark will have benefited from.
So you get a bonus basically for winning Constructors?
Yes, of course. Yeah. Because the team, as you've quite rightly pointed out, the difference from seventh to eighth, from fifth to fourth, from definitely from second to first, it's a big, big difference. And like any business, you know, that does well on revenues, it's some of it is distributed to the people that help them gain that. So yeah, of course there's incentives, there's that. But I don't think people actually, you know, if you are involved with a Formula One team, or with Formula One teams, as you know, for if you've got a long career in Formula One, let's say as an engineer, as a mechanic, you know, like Mark and I have had, you don't get out of bed. You know, that's not your main focus. Your main focus is the prestige, the fact that, you know, there's other benefits that come with it as well. There's other fringe benefits of being higher in the Constructors' Championship, of being world champions. But the main thing is the passion that drives you. It's the prestige. It's that we are world champions, right? So definitely within a team, it's the number one focus.
Well, I was just going to say, I'd add to that is that there is a sort of varying set of dynamics even within the team, because as Rob will appreciate, when you're working on a particular driver's car, like you did with Felipe, you know, I did with Kimi for many years, for example, in that situation, you know, that small crew of teammates around the driver on a particular car, you desperately want that driver to win the driver's championship. I always felt that gave me an element of sort of prestige, and it was definitely my focus was to get my driver to win the world title. From a team's perspective, the constructor's perspective, you've still got, of course, thousands of other people within that team who don't necessarily work with one driver or the other. And I always felt that for those people, that was when the Constructors' Championship really did make a massive difference, because they didn't have the same direct influence on one car over the other. They didn't necessarily care which one of their drivers won. But for the Constructors, that was a real bonus for everybody in the team, and really felt something. And the other point I was going to make, Rob, has anyone from Middlesbrough ever won the Ballon d'Or?
I think Ravinelli was very close once.
He sat next to it in a taxi. I mean, when we're talking about the bonuses, though, I mean, we're not sort of talking about, you know, they get a few Amazon vouchers at Christmas. I mean, this is, I know people who've like been able to buy a car or put an extension on their house with a few years of success in the constructors. So, I mean, these are meaningful things. As you say, it's not their primary objective of the people on the shop floor in the team, but they desperately want to win it. But Jake, I mean, we're talking about these two great names, you know, McLaren and Ferrari. Not that Red Bull Racing isn't a great name, who've been winning a lot recently, but you know what I mean. I mean, first of all, are Red Bull genuinely out of it? I think they're 53 points behind McLaren. Do you see no chance of a Checo Perez late season renaissance that brings them back into the game? Are we really talking about McLaren versus Ferrari?
I think so. And to be fair to Sergio, it's not been, well, it has been quite a dire season from his perspective. He said as much, Christian Horner said as much. He scored 49 points in the last 16 races. And his gap to Max Verstappen is bigger than it's ever been. I was doing a little bit of maths yesterday to work out basically the average finishing gap between a champion and their teammate. And Perez versus Verstappen, that's the biggest gap since Johnny Herbert and Michael Schumacher in 1995 between drivers.
That's a great stat. Can I just say that is a great stat? That's why he gets the big bucks.
Not for Johnny Herbert, it's not.
I can see it.
So, obviously, yeah, it's been pretty much a one-man army this season. And, you know, Max can't win a Constructors' Championship on his own. It's about having two drivers that are very, very close together. And Ferrari has that. It's very, very evenly matched lineup. McLaren, Piastri's blown hot and cold this season. There have been races where he's been fantastic and clearly the better driver. Other races where he's been really, really off of it and has qualified pretty badly, and he's not been able to recover from those situations. So yeah, I think Red Bull's very much out of this at the moment. The consolation it does have is going to have much more wind tunnel time next year. Much more wind tunnel, much more CFD testing time, which is something it hasn't had because obviously cost cap penalty as well. It had a couple of seasons ago, so it lost even more. It's now going to be on, what, if it finishes third, I think 85% of the base aero testing level. So, you know, that gives it a few extra hours in the wind tunnel.
What do you get for, what is it if you win the championship?
If you win, it is 70 or 75%. I don't have the numbers.
So basically it's like a handicap system, just to explain to listeners who aren't fully au fait with this. You have it's basically the higher you finish in the championship, they take away time in the wind tunnel. It's sort of, it's a leveling up mechanism. We've never really had leveling up in Formula One before. It's always been an out and out dog eat dog meritocracy, but it is the benefit of that we're all seeing now, because we've seen some records we've not had before in terms of the number of multiple winners, four different teams winning multiple races. I personally believe that 2025 season will be the most competitive season of Formula One, certainly during my career. I think going back a long, long way for a season that will have been as competitive as that. But as you've raised the topic of the driver lineups, let's dive into that. Mark, going to come to you. I mean, you've got your old team, you've got Lando Norris and Oscar Piastri, and then at Ferrari, they've got Carlos Sainz, who's obviously on a mission because he's leaving Ferrari. He said when he won in Mexico, he definitely wanted to win one more, and I'm sure he'd like to win another one before he exits. Leclerc has been pretty steady and consistent this year. He's had some real highs, some great victories, and he's got Lewis Hamilton as a teammate next year. But which of those two driver lineups, as we sit here now, do you think is the stronger?
Well, I think, you know, at times like this, you often experience really comes into its own when the sort of pressure's on. And when it comes to experience, clearly that sort of favours Ferrari. If you look at the season, I think McLaren have got two incredible young drivers, but they are young drivers. And don't forget, neither of them had even won any races before this season had started. Now we're talking about challenging for a world title. So there's a huge learning curve that goes with that. And I think that's why we've seen a lot of the mistakes, the errors, the sort of points left on the table, both from the drivers, but also from the team perspective as well, because the team's in exactly the same boat, as you said, not won a title or a constructor title since 98. So that's a long time of not being in a position to consistently win to suddenly now being in that phase. So I think we're seeing 2024 as a really steep learning curve for the drivers and team. I agree with you. I think 25, McLaren have an amazing opportunity to hit the ground running with the benefit of all that experience. In terms of who the sort of remainder of 2024 favours, I would say that in terms of pure driving, I would go for the reliability and the experience of the two Ferrari drivers. And that's not to take anything away from the McLaren drivers, because I think they're both potential world champions. But I think right now, you really want to lean on experience at this phase of a very long and competitive season.
So you were both racing against each other for McLaren, for Ferrari back in those great, great years. I was commentating on ITV. It was absolutely epic, some of those scraps between those two teams. But what was the competitive tension like within the team? What do you remember of those days, you taking on McLaren? And Rob, what was it? What was it like, them as an adversary?
Oh, I think it was, I mean, I'd be interested to hear what Mark thinks from the other side of the fence, but I think it felt very, very competitive. It felt extremely competitive. I think Formula One's like that, you know, you will go up to the boundaries and sometimes slightly beyond of what would be called good behavior, in order to beat your rivals. So I think it was intensely competitive. You know, I can remember at the end of both of those seasons, the amount of kind of mental, you know, the amount of horsepower that you have to put into that, the fact that you just never rest from it, it becomes a thing in itself in how competitive it is.
Because, like an obsession.
Yeah, you're almost obsessed. You know, you are obsessed. You're obsessed in beating the other team. I'm not quite sure. And don't forget, you know, you're talking about two very strong teams who'd been strong for a long time at that period, at that point in time. I think Mark makes a really good point here, is that Ferrari haven't won anything for a long time. McLaren haven't won anything for a long time. They're both in a nice period, let's call it. They're both in a period where, I don't want to say whatever happens, they're going to be happy, but certainly they're moving forward from where they've been in the recent past. You know, again, as Mark said, you know, the two McLaren drivers hadn't won a race until the start of this season. So they're in new territory now. Once you get into that position where you are used to winning, you learn how to win again, then you learn how to win world titles. And once you've learned how to do that, it becomes that the level of competition goes up. And I think the intensity between the two teams goes up. So any kind of, you know, semi-friendships that you did have in those teams, they get put aside until sometime in mid-December.
Exactly. And there is bad blood. I mean, there was certainly a lot of bad blood in 07, 08, because you had the whole Spygate scandal going on, which involved McLaren and Ferrari and Ferrari employees and McLaren employees copying files and all that sort of stuff, which is unprecedented, really, and certainly was a massive, massive moment. But even this year, you know, you've had the whole thing with rear wings, and everybody's always thinking the other side is cheating. But what do you remember of the bad blood of those times, Mark, and how do you compare it to today?
Well, I sort of remember a combination of both bad blood, or not so much bad blood, but really intense competition, as Rob described, and you do become obsessed with it, obsessed with winning. You know, the outcome is the only thing that matters at that point. But I also remember a really good relationship with the guys, you know, my opposite numbers at Ferrari. So in the pit lane, yeah, we'd battle hard during the day, but in the evenings and at the end of a race, you know, we'd sort of, we'd have a laugh together, and we you know, both teams, I think, were very graceful. Whenever on a day that we won or they won, there was a real good respect between the two. One thing that I find interesting is in today's Formula One, particularly with the advent of social media, which we didn't really have back then, you're seeing fans become so kind of vociferous towards each other, aren't they? They're kind of, it's almost like a football crowd at times now, where you can't be a fan of both drivers. As members of the media, I'm sure we can all appreciate, you can't say a good word about Max without the British fans jumping on you, or you can't say something nice about Lando without the opposite happening. But actually back then, I remember fans being very much like football crowds, particularly between those two teams. And, you know, I remember going to Monza in the heat of, in fact, it was actually the Mika Hakkinen Schumacher days, which was when I first started. In those days, it was so intense that I remember going to Monza and we had to go in plain clothes instead of our normal team kit because the team was so worried about Italian baggage handlers, you know, wrecking and stealing stuff. I remember walking through the paddock in that little fenced area to get to the paddock at Monza and people trying to reach through and grab my shirt. And, you know, it was angry days back then, but it was all about this intense competition on track. The moment it was over, though, a little bit like you saw between Max and Lando in the pen post-race in Las Vegas, the moment it's over, you're all kind of best of friends. And ultimately, there is a total respect underlying all of this. And it's just at a surface level, you desperately want to win. Now we've got the Drivers' Championship done. I think that's what we're going to see for the last two races is respect between drivers, certainly teammates, because no one's got anything to go for. Lando versus Oscar, that's now just a team battle where they can help each other. It's not about favouring one driver or the other. So I think we should get a sort of a last two rounds where we've got a little bit of relaxation from the drivers in terms of there's no intense battle for them, but also a couple of racetracks which really suit both teams, and we should get some really close battles on circuit.
Let's talk a little bit about the personalities involved. We'll come back to the personalities who were leading McLaren and Ferrari back in those days, which is Jean Todt and Ron Dennis, two huge characters and huge figures in the sport of Formula One. Today, their counterparts are Fred Vasseur at Ferrari and Zak Brown at McLaren. Jake, I mean, first of all, when you talk about blood between teams, there's like a bromance between those two anyway, which has developed during the course of this year. Zak is a very affable character. You know, he's all about the money. He's all about the marketing. But he's a racer down. And so is Fred in a different kind of way. How do you see those two personalities in their competition?
Well, Fred is very sort of, he's a very good humoured man. And he sort of, maybe he looks a little bit grumpy when you first meet him and you're kind of a little bit worried. But actually, you know, he puts you at ease and clearly, he's got a real brain for this. Obviously, he's been involved in setting up his own businesses for many, many years, ran the ASM team in F3 ART during some of the most successful years in GP2. So he's had that grounding, and then he's worked his way through Formula One. And clearly, the Ferrari role has come at the right time. It clearly needed some shaking up because I think, let's say, the last sort of two eras of team principals under Binotto, under Arriva Bene, maybe there was this sort of fear that the, and I don't know if this was a situation when you were there, Rob, but I think when I first started watching F1, there was this suggestion that there was this like fear culture at Ferrari sometimes. And it felt like that went away and then it sort of came back. And now under Vasseur, I think people sort of feel a little bit more free and easy to explore ideas. There's not so much pressure from the Italian media. I know, you know, I think when Ross Brawn joined Ferrari at the first, it was it 96, I think, banning Italian newspapers from the factory floor just to stop people sort of reading it and feeling the pressure quite so much. But then on the other side, you've got McLaren, and as you say, Zak Brown is a very, very affable man. But he knows, he's a man that is aware of his kind of limitations in terms of how the actual running of an F1 team, which is why Andrea Stella is there. And I think Stella is such an impressive person when you speak to him. Everything has such clarity. He'll explain something to you and you kind of feel away like you've learned something. So I think you've got these two very, very, I don't know how to describe it, but I feel like there's this huge amount of competitiveness from within, but everybody's so open. There doesn't seem to be, perhaps when I started watching F1, everyone sort of felt a little bit more secretive and a little bit more guarded. You don't get that from these two camps. It just sort of feels like a very open fight, but it's done in a good-natured way, which I think weirdly stands in contrast to how tribal, as Mark has explained, how tribal F1 has perhaps become. It does seem to be such a much more open arena.
It's interesting. I mean, they're both employees of big companies, Zak Brown and Fred Vasseur. They're highly paid, they're very senior, but at the end of the day, they're very well-established businesses now, and those are employees. If you go back to when you guys were racing each other, Mark and Rob, you had Ron Dennis, who basically built the McLaren Formula One team as we know it today, and Jean Todt, who came along in Ferrari's long history, but he really built the Ferrari Formula One team as it is today, because it was spread all over the place. It was pretty chaotic when he arrived in the 90s. And these were beasts that understandably had felt more proprietorial about the whole thing. Ron Dennis was actually a shareholder. He was the owner of the team. Jean Todt felt a degree of being the proprietor there. How different was the dynamic just living that compared to what you see of the Zak Brown Vasseur battle now?
Well, I think you know, culture comes from the top down, right? So I think the intensity of the competition and the obsession with winning within at all costs, within the bounds of what you're allowed to do, that definitely come from those two people. You know, they were driving that culture. If there's a more affable, more open culture now, with the characters that we've got, I would be interested to see, you know, how long that lasts, because like any kind of deterioration, like any deterioration in a relationship which is intense, like those between teams in Formula One, it only needs somebody to misstep, and then the whole sea of vitriol that was sat waiting to come out suddenly comes out in a tsunami, and we've seen that lots of times before between teams. So I think that, you know, it was a different era as well. I think we've got to remember, James, but certainly, you know, I can't comment on what Ron was like. You know, Mark will be able to give us better insight there. But Jean was intensely competitive. And I think Mark picked up on a point there, which was you become obsessed about winning. But because you're so obsessed about winning, you don't actually celebrate your success. And that's something that I find now. I think I spoke to Mark about this at some point in the recent past. You forget how to celebrate success, because when you win, it's like tick box, okay? Like you breathe a sigh of relief for literally like 5-10 minutes after the race, and then you're obsessed about thinking about the next one. You know, you don't care about your past successes. And it was even like that with world championships. You know, you kind of got a world championship, and you know, that would last a little bit longer than 10 minutes. That would go into the Sunday evening in Brazil, invariably. But by the Monday morning on the plane back home, you're just obsessed about next year. So I think that level of obsession definitely come from those two characters. I can say without a doubt it come from Jean. He was very methodical. He has a brilliant mind, you know, a very, very strong mind. Doesn't miss anything. You know, if you think that, one thing what I learned about Jean is if you think, you know, with people like him, if you have any notion that you're going to pull the rug from under his feet or pull the wool over his eyes, forget it, you're not. Because he knows everything that's going on inside that team, you know, and he was across everything as well. He had his trusted lieutenants, and for whatever reason, he was always brilliant with me from the minute I got there. You know, he kind of acted like a mentor to me. And I don't know why, he kind of maybe saw something or whatever. And that was really good. I learned so much from him. But I learned as well, if we're really talking about it, you know, that intense level of competitiveness, that obsession to win.
Well, you're speaking about obsession to win. I don't think I've ever met anybody with more of an obsession to win than Ron Dennis. I was actually in a room with him after it all kind of went wrong with Alonso and Hamilton in 07. And he actually said, there was only about four or five of us in the room. He came out with this line I'll never forget. It was so chilling. He goes, "Competitive animals know no limits." And he was talking about Alonso. And you know, this was a mess of the highest order. And yet, he admired it. He admired the degree to which Alonso was just so completely competitive, because he was like that as well, wasn't he, Mark? And I mean, what do you remember of those times, and how do you compare him to the personalities we have leading the teams today?
Yeah, I think very different. Like Rob says, it is different times. But yeah, Ron was just such an intense character and so obsessive about being the best and about winning. And I think there was as much personal pride, probably more personal pride than anything else. I mean, as you rightly said, the team was his baby. You know, he built it up from almost nothing. He had a personal interest in this. you know, landing a big sponsor, that reflected on him. The way the team looked, the way they portrayed themselves, it all reflected on him. And of course, winning was the biggest accolade you could have that then reflected on him. So he was incredibly intense. His attention to detail, I mean, I've never, ever met anybody like it. He's literally changed me from, you know, into somebody who now cares about whether there's a little bit of bin liner sticking outside the edge of the bin.
Do you go around straightening pictures when you're in someone's house and his picture's not straight? Yeah. Do you go around straightening them up? I've seen him do that many times.
Honestly, it even drives me crazy. So you can imagine how my wife feels when I unpack the dishwasher to reload it in a slightly more efficient way. That's all come from Rob. you know, but yes, when, you know, as Rob did say, it starts at the top, and you know, we all, that's the example I've just given, we all morph into a little bit of the leaders that we sort of follow. So we're, the culture that we're within rubs off on us, and you know, there are lots of great things that have come from that now enable me to have success in other aspects of my life. So I have total respect for his attention to detail and his obsessiveness, but it's also sometimes a really difficult, you know, operation to work within, because we're not all Ron Dennis and we don't have that same level of obsession. So there's a lot of people that found that very difficult at times, but ultimately, you know, he generated a lot of success with his way of working in that period of time. You could argue that, you know, those leaders that we're talking about, the Jean Todds, the Ron Dennises, you know, the Eddie Jordans of this world, they were all there of a time and they suited that time. Even you could even say Bernie Eccleston, similar type of character, perfect for that era, maybe not so much in the modern era where the world has changed, expectation on people has changed, the way that, you know, what the fans expect, what the sponsors expect, the product that we now portray on TV, it all requires a little bit more modern thinking. And I think that's where the likes of Zach and Fred and others have perhaps come in and had to step in to run the sport from here on in.
I can completely relate to that. I mean, I was very fortunate I wasn't close to them in the sense that you were close because you were working for them, but I was observing them. I wrote books with them, about them. I made TV programs with them, about them. I actually, you know, I don't mind admitting that there are various times in the last 20 years when I've been in situations and I've thought, how would Jean Todt approach this? Or what would Ron Dennis do in this situation? Do you know what I mean? Or what would Michael Schumacher, how would Schumacher think about this? Just in everyday life. And it helped me. It definitely helped me. I mean, is that there is something that comes off these people. They're very, very special people. And we all benefit from that. There's no question. I mean, you obviously did. But Jake, we could benefit from your knowledge on this one. So we are where we are. There's 24 points in it with these two final rounds to go. And it's these two teams. We've established that. But the fact that they haven't won for such a long time, since the period we've been talking about to the period where we're there, what went wrong?
Well, I think if you look at McLaren's case, it was a very, very long extended period of this decline. And I think you can probably look at the hallmarks of that in 2011, 2012. That's when things started to fall off, and you had this sort of very convoluted technical structure where you have one group designing one car and you'd have another group designing the next car. And then there was the loss of the Mercedes works contract as well. And this sort of rot seemed to set in, I would say, at McLaren. And when Ron Dennis came back in charge, he was like, okay, we're adamant that we need to be this, we need to be a works team. We're only going to win if we're a works team. And so the Honda deal happened. Obviously, we know how that went, which was quite terrible for the team. And it took a number of years licking their wounds. And so this leads to the point where Zach Brown comes in, and he's got basically pretty much a blank car at this point. He's asked for it to be painted orange, but there's not many sponsors on it. He's got Fernando Alonso and Stoffel Vandoorne in the cars, and there seems to be this sort of Alonso versus the team. Switch to Renault doesn't go well. Since then, it's been this continued period of growth. There's been so much focus now on the technical structure of the team. There's in recent times, there's this new wind tunnel. Everything seems to be night and day different. It seemed to be McLaren continued in the way that it had for a number of years, and it needed a disruptor to come in and change effectively everything about it. I suppose Ferrari is pretty much the same. I suppose it didn't have that long extended period of being right at the back of the field sometimes. But I just suppose that, you know, that sort of rotating cast of different leaders, you had that sort of engine, let's say controversy in, what was it, 2019, 2020, the ramifications thereof and the fall off. And again, it's required a management rethink and a management change to say, this is what we need to do. We can't try and keep on doing what we've always been doing. People haven't been afraid to change things. And you're seeing that, I think you're seeing that at Williams now as well, actually. James Vowles come and say, look, there's so much things that have been the same for the last 20 years and we need to break the team out of its stupor a little bit. I think that's the main thing. It's just not being afraid to make the changes to fit a more modern world, as Marcus sort of alluded to. Things now do require a very different look at the way they do things. Teams are so much bigger now. They don't have the testing that they used to have. It just requires something different from everybody involved, not just the management, but from personnel as well.
I was just going to say, I think that, I mean, Jake makes some good points, and I think I would put it like this, is that I don't think that, maybe a slightly controversial statement, but I don't think Formula One is that hard. I think there's basic building blocks of what you have to do to win. What those building blocks are not hard to recognize. It's very, very difficult to execute. It's extremely difficult to execute. And then you layer on top how competitive the environment is, it makes it more difficult again. But I think when you see teams that go into the wilderness, it's often for two reasons, and this definitely happened at McLaren. First of all, you're not being honest with yourself, right? You're not being honest about where your shortfalls are. And if you can't be honest, you're dead in the water. Honestly, you're whatever it's costing you per race, multiply it by 22, 24 races, you may as well take it outside and put it in the dustbin and burn it. And that's what they were doing for some years. Once they had a change of management, I think what actually happened was they got more honest with themselves, and then they put about what is a sensible plan of rebuilding. And as long as you've got the finances and the resource to be able to do that, and the people who understand how to do it and how to execute, then actually to get onto a road of success, again, is, you know, my opinion is, it's not actually that difficult. But if you're spending time being dishonest with yourself about where your shortcomings are, you know, whether that's the team, whether that's the car itself, whether that's the infrastructure, whatever it is, then, you know, you're not going to go anywhere. And I think that's what happened at McLaren for a long time.
I really like that. I really like what you were saying, Jake, because it reminded me, you know, Rob and I did a podcast recently with Dr. Ian Graham, who's part of the Liverpool backroom staff that built this great team. And when we were chatting with him after the show, he was talking about how Manchester United basically hadn't sort of taken their medicine since Sir Alex Ferguson left. They'd kept sort of trying to do different versions of the same thing, and they still find themselves struggling, whereas Liverpool had accepted they're going to be terrible for a few years. But they just basically did exactly what you say, Jake, and just kind of went back to square one and rebuilt. And I think it's the same in football, same in Formula One, and that makes a lot of sense. You're still in touch, I'm sure, Mark, with people at McLaren. There's, one of the things I admire about that team is there's a lot of people who've been there for many, many years. When you go and visit down in Woking, you see a lot of very familiar faces. What's the mood like in the team now under Zak Brown and Andrea Stella's leadership?
It's amazing. It's honestly, I've never seen it. Even through all of my time when we were winning, I've never seen an environment as positive as the one they've got right now. And it's not just come about because they've started to get the good results. It's come about because intentionally they've changed the culture. And it's taken a few years. You know, I see fans messaging me all the time on social media saying, you know, what on earth happened to McLaren since midway through the season? They've been brilliant. It's not since midway through the season. They started this process, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, where they started to rebuild, as you've just described, rebuilding from the inside out, changing sometimes just small things, but things that affect the culture. And when you've got a long-standing culture in an organization of not winning, consistently not winning, and they weren't even just not winning, they were right down the back, it has so many knock-on effects that become deep-rooted to things like your confidence, the way that you make decisions within that organization. And even at the start of this season, if you look at McLaren, you can think of some of those races where they left points on the table through maybe indecision or poor decision. Canada is a great one that springs to mind, when they had that split second moment where they could have pitted Lando, you know, for that safety car, and they missed the opportunity because they didn't make the decision quick enough. And I'm pretty sure that comes down to not having the confidence to do so. Because, you know, when you've consistently not been winning, you're never going to have that confidence. You're going to be worrying about the consequences of that being an incorrect decision. And the likes of Red Bull, who've been winning consistently, they were able to make the decision instantly. I know they had a few more seconds on the racetrack, but these are the kind of things that have changed in McLaren over the last few years. The way that your daily routine operates at the team, the way you feel empowered and you know, how you're looked after as a representative of that team, everything's changed about the culture. And so, winning or otherwise, everybody feels very, very positive about the future. My one concern, if it's a concern at McLaren, is that 2025 feels like their biggest opportunity, you know, for all of those years, 20 years or whatever it is. And it could well be, because they should hit the ground running in 25. But it might also be their one opportunity, because in 26, who knows what happens? It's a brand new restart for the team. When you peak in terms of performance, and they may well carry this through into 26, but it may be that 25 is their one shot to get it all right. And that obviously ramps up the pressure. So I'll be interested to see how this new culture and team really deals with that for the very first time.
Can I enter something else into this debate here, just very, very quickly? And it goes back to what Rob said about setting the culture from the top. If you listen to everything that Andrea Stella says about the mistakes that the team made, he never says that, you know, we've made a mistake or we got this wrong. He always says there's an opportunity to learn from this. Or there's, let's say, for example, when Lando was struggling with starts, he'd never say, you know, Lando needs to improve or Lando needs to get better or Lando made a mistake here. He always says there's an opportunity for Lando to do better. Everything, there's always an opportunity. It's all about this messaging that, yes, that's something that we've got wrong, but we can make this better and we will make this better. Everything's an opportunity to improve. And I've noticed that the drivers have started saying that as well. I've noticed that, I think after Las Vegas, Lando said, oh, I had an opportunity to do something a bit better. And I'm like, this is filtering through. I can kind of understand his rationale now.
Yeah, I mean, and that's being kind of gentle on yourself, shall we say, as a person and as an organization. If I'm being really honest, the thing that's frustrated me about McLaren this year, because they have had the fastest car for the bulk of the year. And in my world, the world I've kind of observed for many years, normally you use that competitive advantage and you ram it home. Yeah. And in the culture that you were in, that you grew up in at Ferrari, and Andrea Stella, who's the McLaren boss now, but he was part of that culture with you at Ferrari, led by Todd, the tone being set by Schumacher, that was ruthlessness personified. You never, ever, ever let anybody have a sniff of a chance if you had a competitive advantage. And so for me, the thing I'm a little bit frustrated about with McLaren is that they weren't more ruthless at certain key moments, whether it's Lando not shutting the door on Verstappen into turn one in Austin, or whether it's many of the decisions from the pit wall, or the team orders thing that never happened in Hungary. All these moments throughout the year that it just, culturally, for me, they just weren't Schumacher enough.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. And it's an opinion. That's all it is. It's not. Candidly, I would personally do things differently. I've seen decisions made, not driving, obviously, because I'm not a Formula One driver yet. definitely there's still time. But Lando, you're right. There's been bits where, Max on the, let's talk about Max for a while. Max is utterly ruthless on the racetrack. Max will give no quarter, to the point that his driving standards often go too far and he's penalised for it. Lando hasn't done that on occasion, and I think that he needs to learn how to do it, because we might still have a Drivers' World Championship on our hands at this point if we added some of that and a little bit of the team as well. But perhaps it comes back to what Mark was saying. It's that self-confidence of being able to make, you're empowered to make a decision. I'm going to make that decision. Sometimes you have to make decisions both in the within the team between the two drivers and or external to your team with your competitor that you know is not going to make you look like a very nice person or a very nice team or a very nice culture. But how much does that matter when the stakes are so high and the competition is so intense? So yeah, I do agree with you on that, James.
One thing I would say is if you go back to look at any sporting team's era of dominance, whether that's in football or racing or whatever, think about Mercedes before they went on their long run of success, Red Bull the same. The year before they get into that run, maybe the couple of years before, it's always like the one that McLaren have just had, where it has occasional successes and some epic failures. And that's the real steep learning point when these things are being figured out. And then you go on to put it into practice. So I don't think there's anything unusual about what we've seen from McLaren. And I don't want to be overly critical about McLaren this year because, yeah, they've left points on the table, they've made mistakes. But it's part of that process to getting into a phase where they could then go on and have a period of domination.
But they've got to then go on and do that. As you say, very good point. You know, the window is closing. Next year, they really have to take advantage. And when we're speaking about next year, they're going to be fighting it out again, I'm sure. Red Bull, I'm sure, will come back strong. I know Mercedes feel they've got a clear understanding now of what went wrong with their car this year, and they're going to fix it for next year. But I'm thinking now back to this constructors' battle. How much does Lewis Hamilton getting into a Ferrari raise their game as a competitor?
Oh, I think that this, it can go one or two ways, obviously, like everything. But I think that this will just give them, the whole team, that extra 1-2%. Because that's all teams often need. And that's what, you know, Mark's basically just said there, is you go from something, you know, a team which is slightly hit and miss to this winning machine. And certainly that happened to Ferrari, you know, just at the point where I was joining, you know, we were just starting to dominate. They were moving from something which was a bit hit and miss to this, like, you know, really dominant machine. And that comes from, you know, there's just a few things that click into place. It's learning from your mistakes. It's being honest about them, but it's having that self-confidence as well. Yeah.
Excellent. So final word on this topic then to all of you. And I just need a one-word answer from each of you. Jake, you can go first. Who is going to come out on top and win the 2024 Constructors World Championship?
McLaren.
Rob?
McLaren.
McLaren. Yeah, same.
It's a full set for McLaren. Okay. Very
Watch
interesting.
Watch us be wrong.
Well, remember to send in your questions to @JamesAllenF1 on Twitter/X or email us JamesAllenF1@autosport.com. We've got this one in from Russ, who sent this on X. I understand why people are saying this is Max's best championship to date to validate his stature in the sport and so on. But surely his most impressive title has to be 2021, with such a fierce fight with a title rival, nip and tuck all season. Of course, the flawed finale makes everyone shy away from this topic. What do you think? Jake, quick word on that.
Oh, God. I think this one has been, he's not had a car that's always been capable of victories. I think in 2021, he largely did. It was Red Bull or Mercedes at a coin flip. This year, he's had to build and maintain a title rather than just add wins on top of it and cruise to it. And I think this year, maybe Austin and Mexico aside, he's shown incredible maturity. Even at the races, you know, like in the sort of European period of the season when the Red Bull wasn't very good, he was still either winning or getting podiums or just maximising his points. And I think that's what championships are built off of when you don't have the best car.
Yeah, I think I agree with that as well. Okay, well, we're going to round it up there. My thanks to Rob Smedley, Mark Priestley and Jake Boxall-Legg. Check out Mark's podcast, Pit Lane Life Lessons, on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. Make sure you check out Jake's F1 stories across Autosport and follow Autosport podcasts across this week's Qatar Grand Prix. Where can we follow you, Rob? Are you on social media?
Well, I'll be in Abu Dhabi next week. You can follow me there.
Well, I will actually. I'll be there too. My thanks to Dre, Matt and Jason on production. And thanks to you all for listening. Please click to follow or subscribe. Leave us a review and a rating and tell all of your F1 mad friends about us. Share it with one of them today. Why not? We love seeing new listeners discovering the podcast and we'll be back with another one very soon.